Our topic, brethren, is judgments. Improper, improper. The fact that there are improper judgments is very adequately brought out by Matthew 7, 1 and 2. Judge not, that ye be not judged. What judgment ye judge, it shall be meted unto you. With Romans 2, 1 and 2, who art thou, O man, that judgest another? For the very thing thou judgest him, thou shalt thyself be judged, and are guilty of the same. 1 Corinthians 4, 3, Paul says, I judge not my own self. The fact that there are proper judgments is also scriptural. In 1 Corinthians 6, 2 and 3, Paul says, do you not know that the saints that judge the world, and if the world should be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge as law as matters? 1 Corinthians 5, verses 12 and 13. What have I to do to judge them also that are without? Do not ye judge them that are within? Them that are without, God judgeth. So we do have places of judgment, proper and improper. To harmonize the two is the topic we're given. We're going to look at it, as time permits, in five areas. The first area is our judgment of ourselves. The second area is our judgment of others. The last three areas deal with our judgment within ecclesias. First, from the standpoint of our judgment in selection of elders and deacons, speakers, platform. Second, in the judgment of decisions within the ecclesia framework. And third, judgment from the standpoint of disfellowshipping, judgment that we also see in the scripture. When it comes to judging ourselves, and you notice that the program implies that this is particularly as we are in the latter days, particularly as we are approaching the climax of the age, how do these judgment principles affect us? The fact that the latter days do show that we need to be very careful in the judgment of our own selves is brought out in 2 Peter 3:11, where after describing the difficulties of the latter days, he says, seeing then that all these things are going to be dissolved, what manner of persons ought we to be in all holy conversation and godliness? Not that the standard at the end of the age would be any different or any higher than the standard during the age, but rather that the temptations to fall from that standard would be a particular intensity. And that's sort of what the implied theme text of our convention brings out, that in the latter days perilous times would come. The principles of self-judgment are principles that should look very deep within our hearts to test at all times whether the actions that we are doing for the proper motivations. Whether we are doing the Christian thing because we want to be Christians, and not just doing the Christian thing because we want to appear to be Christians. Because this is the Bible student formula of how things are done. So this needs to be a reading of the heart and the motive and the action, that we are carefully following the Lord, not carefully following some formula for Christianity. Because the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, it requires that this judgment be very personal and very intense. One of the best places to apply this judgment is during a discourse. When we hear a discourse, do we apply that principles that we're hearing to ourselves, or do we think how beautifully this applies to Brother So-and-so? Self-judgment is self-application. I've told Vincent before, but I think it bears repeating. My employer, a newspaper publisher, was telling me about his early days in the business, and what a big deal to put up with the newspapers, our chambers of commerce. They're ridiculous. So frequently, in these chambers of commerce, you find no real interest in the chamber except each one, what can this do for my business, not for the community as a whole. And so finally he had enough of it, and he wrote a scathing editorial. And his partner said, you don't dare deliver the paper this week. They're not getting any more advertising for the paper out. But he said, I'll deliver it. And he was mad enough to do it. He got down to the corner drugstore, and the druggist met him, and he said, I read your editorial. That was fantastic. I hope the jeweler read it. You can imagine what the jeweler said. That's right. He said he hoped the druggist read it. Self-examination is self-judgment. But we must be careful in doing it, that we realize we're fallen flesh. That if we are really holding the principles and standards of righteousness to their highest, we can get awfully depressed in looking in and seeing we're not making it. We're not going to make it. We have to apply the same rule of judgment upon ourselves that the Lord applies to us. That rule is the one given in 2 Corinthians 8:12. If there be first a willing mind, it is according to a man to what he has and not what he has not. And that balances the principle of self-judgment. Section 2. We have to cover the sections fast because 27 minutes is a short time. Our judgment of others. Probably the single best rule to apply in our judgment of others can be said in one word. Don't. We don't have the necessity to make individual judgments of others. I'm not saying there aren't places where judgment of others comes in, but we don't have the necessity to make individual judgments of others. For some very basic principle reason, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5:16, henceforth know we no man after the flesh. Although we do. Unfortunately, we see the flesh of each other all around us. It's the flesh that irritates. It's not the new creature. It's the flesh that makes us want to get in there and get our little digs or our little statements to another about another. The little judgments that we make come because of this. But how do you look not upon one in the flesh, but upon the new creature? You look upon one another, the new creature, by looking in the robe of righteousness. And when you start judging the robe of righteousness, you're not judging the other, you're judging Jesus Christ. It's his righteousness that is the covering for sin. That same principle we mentioned in 2 Corinthians 8, just as true for our brother, that he is not being judged by what he has done. He is being judged by God of what he is trying to do. He's failing. In fact, I'll grant you, every one of your brothers is feeling pretty good. I'll let you know a secret, so are you. We each come very short of that perfect standard. The Old Testament principle is just as true in the New Testament. The principle that was given when God selected David. Man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. And because we cannot fully see the heart of another, we are not in the position to pass judgment on another. We may disapprove of an action. We may fight an action all the way down the line, but we're not in a position to judge the doer of that action, because we're not in a position to read the heart why that action was done. Sometimes there's personal attacks. I've had personal attacks. They attacked me. They said things about me that weren't true. But they said it because they were upholding the standard of righteousness as they saw that standard. And I was coming short and they were defending truth by saying that Brother Carl has done so and so. Got me mad. Very mad. But I can't judge them. Because their motive was a motive that the Lord is looking at. And probably a motive that was very pure. This distinction between the motive and the action is beautifully brought out by the Lord Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew, the 5th chapter. We'd like to look at this as an illustration of this distinction. Starting in verse 17, he says, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And this word fulfill has a double significance. Not, I am fulfillment of all the types, that's true. But also, as Brother Russell suggests, to magnify. That I am going to magnify what that law is. I'm going to show you the extension of that law as it gets into the inner heart, touches the emotions, touches the motives. Then he says in verse 19, whosoever shall break one of these, I don't like that word least, he's not talking about little commandments, one of these extended commandments he's going to give. Whosoever shall break one of these extensions of these commandments I'm going to bring, he's going to be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But notice, he's in the kingdom of heaven. He's called least. Whosoever shall keep them shall be called great in that kingdom. I say that except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, then you should not even get into the kingdom to find out who kept the least and who didn't. Now that sets a principle right there to look at. When we look at individual judgment, the first advent, there was a lot of judgment going on. Basically by the scribes and Pharisees. They were very quick to pass judgment on the standard of the law. Not on some self-righteous standard. They had a definition, a code for every judgment they passed. Then you see Jesus coming along, very much more lenient in the judgment. Say, my righteousness exceeds their righteousness. You follow my righteousness. But a higher standard of righteousness put him into a less judgmental position of another, into a more compassionate position, because of the distinction between motive and deed. Then he goes on. You have heard it was said, thou shalt not kill. That's a crime. I say unto you, he who hates has committed murder. But he did not say, I'm going to go around and judge every hater, nor that you should judge every hater. Because a hatred was in the heart, and only God can see that heart. Therefore, he said, you have to judge upon the killing. I'm looking at the extension. You're breaking that extension. To the extent that you break that extension, you're lessening your position in that kingdom. He goes and elaborates it. So you have heard it said, verse 27, thou shalt not commit adultery. I say unto you, if you have lusted, you have committed adultery. That lust was the sin of the heart. Like that's the motive. But you can't read the adultery in my heart, and I can't read the lust in your heart, that only God can judge that. And therefore he's not telling them, make this your standard of judgment. Verse 31. It has been said, whosoever to put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say, that whosoever to put his wife, except for the cause of fornication, causing her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committed adultery. So now the law said that it was proper to put away your wife and to marry another. But I'm saying the extension of the law says that is improper. But I'm not saying I'm here judging you on that. I'm not judging you on that any more than I was judging you on the hatred from the other. This is getting into the heart. God knows why you did it. God reads beyond that. It is said, thou shalt not forswear thyself. Thou shalt perform the Lord thy oath. I say you shouldn't swear at all. But you gave the year your name be nay. The same thing. He repeats over and over this principle. He does it six times. The eye for eye, the tooth for tooth, verse 38, and verse 43, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. In each case, what he is showing is that the law has said one thing. There is an extended or deeper commandment beyond this that you should keep. But he's not saying that in applying this deeper commandment, I'm saying this commandment now becomes the standard of your judgment. You know, one of these we sometimes do take up that way. We sometimes take up a situation where there's been unfortunately a divorce. No adultery involved. Remarriage. And we get very much saying, now see, that's adultery. The scripture says so. But we're looking at the extension and not the law. And unfortunately, the principle that comes in here is that same principle that we looked upon in Romans 2. Who art thou, O man, that judgest another? He has just said before this, he who lusts has also committed adultery. How many of us can look into our hearts in the last 1-2 years and say, I never left it after knowing him. I think that'd be a hard question for some of us to answer. I would say. It has happened. Therefore, if I make the judgment here, I am the adulterer of the one extension, accusing the adulterer of the other extension, from the pot calling the kettle black. So he's saying, look into yourself. This is the principle that is used in that story that is supposedly spurious of John 8 chapter, of the adulterous woman. You remember the statement that is made there, John 8, 7, I believe it's the 7-11 verse, let him that is without sin cast the first stone. So you can't really use that because it's spurious. Well, in the first case, it's spuriousness is questionable. Over 300 manuscripts include that. Manuscripts that predate the Sinaitic. So it goes back into very ancient manuscripts. But the evidence is heavy against it. That's very true. The evidence is very heavy. Interestingly enough, every time Pastor Russell uses it, he treats it as authentic. In his writings, page 3434 of the reprints, being one good example. But if it is spurious, it doesn't mean it didn't happen. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means you can't use this as a proof text. It merely means that we don't have the authentic basis for it. And the concept is a concept that is found in the Old Testament. In 2 Chronicles, the 29th chapter, the 8th verse, the little prophecy of a man called Oded. And he saw his brethren coming back, having created judgment upon their other brethren, bring them captive. 2 Chronicles 29, I thought it was verse 8. It's not there. Let me see if I can find where it is. 28, verse 10. And now you propose to keep under the children of Israel and Jerusalem for bondmen and bondwomen to you. But are there not with you, even with you, sins against the Lord your God? He said, you who are without sin, let you be the one to cast the first stone. The cliche, there but for the grace of God go I, is a proper cliche because it recognizes the reality of human frailty. Human frailty is what causes so many actions for which we hold others in judgment. The recognition of human frailty in self should be the greatest security against the use and exercise of judgment against another. Secondly, the recognition of human frailty in self may often show us, if we look, if we apply the first principle of judging self, that we have an ulterior motive to wanting to judge or not. And when that's there, then that means we think that of self. Ecclesia judgments. Judgments are made by the ecclesia regularly in selection and platform. Elders, deacons, speakers. These are based upon principles that never change. The principles of these are listed by Paul in Timothy and Titus, and you know them so well, I'm not going to repeat them all because they're worthy of talking themselves. The investigation of them. Just to say this, there are not three requirements upon which the judgments are based. Frequently we say that. We say requirement for an elder, a deacon, a speaker, is with character, sound doctrine, and in the case of an elder, aptness to teach. Those are three of some 30 characteristics. All of the others relate to the common character, but they must be put into perspective of the whole, which shows the preeminence of the character requirement, the other thing, not unimportant, but relative to the overall concept. And we must be careful in applying this principle of judgment. The recognition that what is stated are the qualifications of a perfect man. And none of us can meet that. So that we are looking at a scale on our judgment. A scale upon which percentage each of us are judging the vision. The Bible does not give that rule of how far down the scale. But to meet those standards, I can tell you exactly how many elders qualify? None qualify to the standard held to its perfection. It is somewhere down a scale, the degree of which is somewhat a variable in your own application. Ecclesia decisions. Here's the judgment we make all the time as ecclesias. decisions to do this, not to do this, to have this activity, not to have this activity, to be involved in this particular thing or not to be involved. These are judgments. Judgments we make as to decisions to make in life. And sometimes the point has been made, we've heard it from the platform, that this becomes increasingly difficult the closer you get to the end of the age, for the very simple theological reason that the closer you get, the higher the percentage of the ecclesia is going to be great company and less little flock, because you are on a closer to the end and you're just replacement in the call. There are two basic fallacies to that statement that we'd like to point out in this ecclesia decision. The first fallacy is, at no time in the church history has the little flock been the majority in any ecclesia. When you think about it, the great company existed throughout the period, out the period of the church, has always outnumbered the little flock. So you can't say this is particularly true here and there. Does this mean that we shouldn't trust the decision? If we don't trust that decision, where do we have to trust? We must be careful that we do not get into the self-judgmental mode, that which reflects the little flock decision is that which reflects my thinking, and that which reflects the great company decision is that which reflects the opposite of my thinking. This because the temptation in the application of this. The second is, we do have a scriptural analogy that I think very closely comes to this point and shows two things. It shows the proper reaction. It also shows the options that are available. In Numbers, the 13, 14, 15 chapters, Israel has come to the land of, to the city of Kadesh Barnea. Moses puts to them the proposition, let's go in and conquer the land. I said, well, don't be too hasty. Are we sure we can do it? So what do you want to do? Investigate. Okay, we'll take one man from every tribe, so you're all represented. We'll send these 12 spies in to investigate. They come back and they're four. Five, six of them, 10 out of 12, say, yeah, the land is worth taking. It's a great land. We can't do it. We're afraid. You can't better describe the great company attitude than the attitude they express. It's good, but fear holds it back. Two said, it's good and the Lord is on our side and let's go. And Moses agrees. But he puts it up to the congregation. The poorer aspect won the vote. You know the vote. It was very high percentage not to go. Then another element enters the picture. God. He approaches Moses and says, they're wrong. And Moses says, I know that. And God said, tell me what you do. Leave them. Let them go their own way. I'll make a new nation out of you, and you can have that land. What would you do if God had offered to you that land? Would you not accept it? So it would be very tempting to accept, because he was the one who introduced it. I didn't start the discussion. He told me what he said. And Moses had the audacity to argue back. He said, if I do that, then what's going to happen to these people? If I'm right and they're wrong, they're going to die. Those people back in Egypt will say, yeah, there's some God. He sent them out of Egypt. He couldn't get into Canaan. He ties it across spiritually. If the ecclesia does represent a great company attitude and decision, the invitation may be there. Leave. I'll bless you doing your own way. But there is an idealism to doing what Moses did. If I am right and they're wrong, then they're going to go from bad to worse. Eventually, they're going to end up the second death. And mankind can always say, oh yes, God could bring many to consecration. He couldn't bring them through. That there is a giving of self to stay with them. As a result, Moses never got there. But they did. The people did. Not those people. Their generation did. Moses' descendants got there. So I think there is an idealism there that argues for this. Time is up before we get to the last one, so we'll cover it quickly. Disfellowshipping in judgment. The scriptures do outline a principle of disfellowshipping. The scriptures outline it in three particular circumstances only. First of these circumstances, they outline it is irreconcilable conflict of brother with brother. And in that particular situation, they say, you don't do it at such a judgment until you've taken several other steps first. Until you've tried every possible method of personal adjustment. And then he outlined principles that are very much similar to our present court principles. Be sure the defendant is in the court. Be sure he has full right to equal the say. Be sure there is total fairness. Be sure there are not extraneous items brought in. Be sure it's very limited to the situation at hand. It's very carefully guarded. The second situation was a very specific, very extreme situation of a man who was living with his father's wife. 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter and the 11th verse. And there Paul says, this situation is a state of fornication. Because it is a continuous state of an action, the church must take a stand. Judgment must be exercised. In 2 Corinthians, it's evident the exercise of judgment. He said, stop it already. Lest they overcome with too much sorrow. You drive them away. It was for a purpose of bringing back one. The third situation of 2 John, the 10th verse, a situation of a departure from the basic doctrine of the ransom. He said, such a person not even just be bread. For one who had turned away fully from Christ himself. Any additional situations to the ones that are here are situations that we may accept, but are not situations that are introduced in the scripture.